Yeah, let me finish my critique of Common Sense Realism in G.E. Moore by just elaborating somewhat on this being conscious of something that's an illusion. We can go beyond that because we know that people are conscious of things that are false. You know, people believe things which are just historically or in terms of natural science false. Now, when somebody believes that which is false, the realist has to explain to us what is the object of their belief. Now, the thing that comes to mind right away is that, well, they're believing a proposition, and that proposition happens to be false. However, that answer was not available to Moore because he argued that, in fact, there are no propositions. There's just states of affairs and consciousness of states of affairs. Now, why aren't there any propositions? Well, the reason for that is that a proposition would be redundant. I'll try to illustrate this for you on the board. The thing that I actually experience is a sense data, or a sense datum, or complexes of sense data. So here I have the actual object of experience, the complex of sensa, or sense data. Now, that complex of sense data, it might be thought, is expressed in a proposition. A proposition is not a sentence. It is what a sentence asserts. So that the same proposition can be asserted by different languages. So when you're speaking French or German or English, you say the same thing. That same thing that's asserted in the different sentences is called a proposition. So now, if we have a proposition, which is what sentences assert, and we have a complex of sensa, or sense data, how do we name these things? Okay, what do I name this complex of sense data? Well, I might name it, my brown dog is sitting on the rug. But now, if I have an assertion to the effect that my brown dog is sitting on the rug, that assertion is actually an expression of a proposition, which is not in English or German or French or what have you. So the proposition is named by the sentence. Here I'll just remind you, it's an English sentence in my illustration. The proposition is named by the English sentence. To put it another way, the English sentence denotes this proposition, but that English sentence also denotes the complex of sense data. And so Moore said, why are we multiplying things in the universe? This English sentence, why should it denote two things? A complex of sensa as well as a proposition. So he said, we don't need propositions. Every belief that we have refers to something, however. And so the question has to be asked, what does a false belief refer to if you don't have propositions as the objects of false beliefs? And let me quote for you how he struggled with this. He says, if you consider what happens when a man entertains a false belief, it seems as if the thing he was believing, the object of his belief, were just the fact, which certainly is not. This, of course, creates a difficulty because if the object certainly is not, if there is no such thing, it is impossible for him or for anything else to have any kind of relation to it. How can you have a relationship to that which doesn't exist? So how could somebody believe what is false if what is false doesn't exist? How then is it possible for anyone to believe in a thing which simply has no being? This is the difficulty, and I confess I do not see any clear solution. And he went on to say, with respect to a false proposition, for instance, the false proposition that he was not in London, when in fact he was in London writing. He says, we must admit, I think, that these words may not really be a name for anything at all. Taken by themselves, they are not a name for anything at all, although the whole expression, he believes that I am not in London, is a name for something. Okay. If someone believes that G.E. Moore is in London, and he falsely believes that, or that he's not in London, whichever the illustration is, if someone believes this false whatever it is, then that, of course, names a reality, because there's a believing out there. But what is the object of the believing? Now listen to this contrived way of getting around the problem. The fact that single words... I've skipped something. He says, taken by themselves, they are not a name for anything at all, although the whole expression, he believes that I'm not in London, is a name for something. This fact that single words and phrases which we use will constantly seem to be names for something, when in fact they are not names for anything at all, because it doesn't exist, is what seems to me to create the whole difficulty. Okay, so this individual believes falsely that G.E. Moore is not in London. Now he says the sentence, he believes that G.E. Moore is not in London, that has an object. There is something in the world, a believing, going on. But now what is this, he is not in London? What is that? And G.E. Moore said, well, you can have meaning for the total expression, but that doesn't mean the parts are all meaningful. He is not in London turns out not to be meaningful, even though the whole expression, so-and-so believes that he is not in London, is. Well, if that doesn't strike you as artificial enough, he ends up, and this is the last sentence in the quotation, he says, and if you understand what the language means, the apparent contradiction doesn't matter. You want to write that one down. Someone says, so-and-so believes that G.E. Moore is not in London. And that's a false belief. And we say, now, how can he... Beliefs always have to refer to. Remember, consciousness is of something. Well, what are you conscious of in the case of a false belief when it's not a proposition? G.E. Moore gave up propositions. He goes, we don't need propositions. We just have complex of sense data. So what are you believing when you believe something falsely? And his answer was, well, if you understand what the language means, the apparent contradiction doesn't really matter. Well, isn't that something of a cop-out? Because the whole point here is to show that there isn't a contradiction and that what we think the language means makes sense. So it is to be questioned whether we really do know that things exist in the realist sense, that there are objects of consciousness which are not themselves dependent on consciousness. How do we know that the contradiction is only an apparent contradiction and not a real contradiction, in which case the whole theory is refuted? All right, so that enthusiasm that we had for realism, that we were going to finally get objectivity into a world that exists and has qualities totally apart from our awareness of them. It didn't get all worked out with G.E. Moore, and as I told you, the neo-realists all eventually moved on to other versions of realism or different theories altogether, because this bright new hypothesis, so promising at the first, turns out upon analysis to have so many internal difficulties and beggings of questions. We all know what consciousness is. Oh, do we? Well, then why are we having all these problems trying to explain consciousness of a brown dog? So let's move on to the next school of thought that's in your outline. The next, by next I don't mean chronologically necessarily, but next in my presentation will be the attempt to recover objectivity through the grand philosophy of phenomenology. Phenomenology. I'm going to offer an overview of what's distinctive about phenomenology, what gives it its general character. The phenomenologist, like the realist, wished to reject the idealistic Kantian notion that the objects of consciousness are constructed in some way by the mind or by consciousness itself. However, the phenomenologist didn't want to get bogged down in G.E. Moore's representative theory of perception, where you have sense data which either represent the object, and we can't ever be sure that they do so properly, or we have the sense data themselves, which are the object, and then we have all the problems that we've already mentioned in realism. So they wanted to get rid of the constructivist notion of the objects of consciousness, that the mind in some way forms what it's aware of, and they didn't want to fall back into representative theories of perception. And so the things which exist appear to us in consciousness. That's why this is called phenomenology. The things which exist do appear to us in consciousness. And yet they are not constructed by our consciousness. This is the program, this is the genius of this position, if it can be carried out. Their view is that things which we know are things for consciousness, and yet they are not constructed by our consciousness. And the assertion of that point of view was dependent upon certain theories advanced by Franz Brentano, 1838 to 1917. He was a psychologist. He had once been a priest in the Catholic Church, and his unorthodoxy led him to resign that position. And he went on eventually to give lectures on descriptive psychology between 1888 and 1889 in Vienna. What Brentano maintained is that there's something important that is named by the word consciousness. It is not, as William James said, something that doesn't exist and that people are just confused if they think they are conscious of being conscious, that is, conscious of consciousness. But for Brentano, and this is what was unique, consciousness is not an idea, it's not a representation of something else, it's not a state of mind, it is a direction. Consciousness is directiveness. Consciousness is intentional in nature. The character of consciousness is to point toward an object. And this notion of consciousness, that it is intentional, it has the directing toward an object character to it, seemed to provide a way out of the idealistic trap where the objects of thought are constructed by thinking itself. Brentano said, when I am conscious of something, like my brown dog, I am not contemplating a private inner representation of the dog, like a mental image or sense data in my mind. Consciousness does not do anything to the sense data of my dog, of which I'm aware. It doesn't work it over or construct it into the form in which I make intelligible my experience of the dog. Consciousness simply discloses or displays things to us. It just has that quality of directing us to something that then the qualities of it are disclosed. Therefore, when I am conscious of something else, what I'm conscious of is the very thing itself, uncontaminated by any kind of mental activity that reforms it or gives it its constructive character or what. Consciousness is not the active mind of Kant, but it's not the passive mind of Locke either. Consciousness is directiveness. It is intentionality. And so phenomenology begins with this insight of Brentano, and based on it, argues that the things which are for consciousness, those things of which I'm aware, are nevertheless not constructed by consciousness, because consciousness is just the direction to the object that discloses its character directly. And so for the phenomenologist, Kant is right that all human experience is limited to phenomena, things for consciousness. There is no noumena. Everything is phenomena, things for consciousness. And yet that doesn't mean that Kant was right, that objects are experienced as constructs of consciousness. So let's rehearse this. Kant is right that the only objects that there are phenomenal. They are for consciousness. But he's wrong to think that the objects are constructed by consciousness. Consciousness doesn't actively work over the input of the senses. It simply, in a kind of not invisible but diaphanous way, puts us in touch with the things themselves. Well, I don't want to say things themselves, that sounds like noumena. Now, according to phenomenology, if we learn to attend very carefully to our consciousness, what we're aware of in experience, we'll become directly aware of an immense variety of different kinds of mental acts and the objects which are intended by those mental acts. Now, this very careful attention to the content of my consciousness comes about through the procedure known as reduction. I must do eidetic reduction, so that ideas are reduced from the content of my consciousness. And that way, you can think of what the phenomenologists were doing as out-Hegeling Hegel. Yes, we have to study consciousness, but we have to do it better than Hegel did. And when we study the content of consciousness, which, as you know, puts us directly in touch with the objects of the world, it just has this directedness that allows things to reveal themselves or to disclose themselves to our consciousness, we'll become impressed with the way in which everything is interconnected. our experience is not a collection of separate sense data, what the realists were doing, but our experience is more like a river. Consciousness flows from one thing into another. Where the realist tended toward a, if you will, a more materialistic conception of the world, wanting to look for actual perceived qualities such as red, spherically, crispness, sweetness, whatever, the phenomenologists are unwilling to write off what we call subjective experiences like love and hate, the sensation of enduring, or the feeling of transitoriness, whatever it may be. The phenomenologists wanted to be real honest about this. If we're going to do an analysis of consciousness, then we can't just arbitrarily say we're going to pay attention to those things which have empirical type qualities. We have to look at what are more subjective qualities as well. That is, we need to do a phenomenology of the life world, as it was said, quote unquote, the life world, the full world of experience. And when we do, we'll see that the objects of our consciousness are all interfused with one another, somewhat like Whitehead wanted to hold. Everything flows together. Everything is connected with everything else. In consciousness, that's true. That's the way we experience the world. Now, why is it that we have philosophical problems at all? Why do we have to do phenomenology at all? Why do we have to stop and look at consciousness and analyze it so we can find out the nature of reality? Well, that's because we ordinarily approach things with preconceptions. And these preconceptions become a barrier to understanding the true nature of the objects of consciousness. If we're going to gain clarity, the phenomenologist says we must bracket all of our preconceptions. We must completely suspend all of our assumptions about the nature of the world and our nature and the nature of ourselves, and try to look at our experience directly rather than indirectly through the spectacles of some philosophical presuppositions. So phenomenologists are radical in their demand that you don't bring to your analysis, the introspection of your experience, any presuppositions. You just want to let the experience directly, quote-unquote, speak to you, reveal its character. And in the process of teaching phenomenological reduction, where we look at this river of experience and directly get some idea of the nature the objects that are real, phenomenologists came to employ a terminology that is elaborate, extremely complex, and to be honest with you, virtually esoteric. So esoteric that in the same way that poor Dr. Bonson reacted negatively to Hegel, I haven't spent a great deal of time studying phenomenology or the works of Husserl directly, because given my analytical personality or background or training, whatever it is, the tendency is to simply be repulsed by all this vocabulary and say, what on earth are all these specialized terms, all this jargon? What is this all about? Well, let's talk about the leading phenomenologist, Edmund Husserl. Husserl lived from 1859 to 1938. He was born in Moravia, which at that time was part of Austria. He studied mathematics, physics, and astronomy. Wrote his dissertation on calculus. But he never really was content to study math and science. He was interested in philosophy, and eventually he gave up the teaching of science. And in 1884, he went to Vienna and attended the lectures of Franz Brentano. He then went on to a career of teaching philosophy at Halle, Göttingen, and Freiburg. And he produced an incredible number of publications, especially after his retirement from teaching in 1928. Let me give you just some of those publications, and then I'll take the question. Philosophy of Arithmetic, 1891. Logical Investigations, 1900. Ideas of a Pure Phenomenology, 1913. Lectures on the Phenomenology of the Inner Time Consciousness, 1928. Cartesian Meditations, 1931. The Crisis of European Science and Transcendental Phenomenology, 1936. And I haven't named them all, but that gives you his major publications. He was very prolific. Okay, what's the question? In that first major publication that I mentioned, Philosophy of Arithmetic, Husserl's understanding of number was in terms of the essences of the numbering concepts which consciousness has produced. That is, if you're going to understand number, you have to look at consciousness of the number concept. And in this way, Husserl said, we can directly see into the essence of the things by looking at the way in which consciousness understands the number concept. And then in the first volume of his Logical Investigations, he argued for the independence of logic, that through phenomenology we can see the universal categorical nature of the forms of logic. We actually grasp the universality of logic in our consciousness. In volume 2 of Logical Investigations, he then generalized this method that he had applied to arithmetic and then to logic. He generalized this method so that it would be applicable to metaphysical problems in general. That is, that everything could be understood in terms of the way in which consciousness experiences things. And at this point, then, for Husserl, phenomenology has become what's called an eidetic science, E-I-D-E-T-I-C, eidetic science, a science that's concerned with mental images, but extracting from mental images the essences from experience. That is, when we look at the river of experience, we introspect, and we see the way in which we experience the world, and we look at our mental images, we can extract from that the essences of the experience. An essence is a constant feature. And phenomenology seeks to sort out, to find and fix upon the constant features of experience. And so phenomenology distinguishes between the contingent features of our river of experience that we're introspecting, which are non-essential, distinguish those features from, if you will, the structure thought has, which is invariant. Certain essential features of all experience can be found when we introspect phenomenologically that river of experience, essential features like universality and especially intersubjectivity. I'm going to get that in your notes. Universality and intersubjectivity. We find that there are certain things in our experience which are intersubjective. Though they are in us and subjective, all thinking has the same form or structure. So it's really intersubjective. You've got that subjectively, I've got that subjectively, and so there's a universality to that. And so what we've done is we've turned our introspection toward the actual experience we have, that flowing river experience, and we've asked what are the features of this. There are some which are changing and contingent, and others which are structural and enduring, like intersubjectivity. Okay, that is just a brief description of the phenomenological science. Let's step back now and take a little bit broader look at what Husserl was doing and why he was doing it and how well it came out. Husserl, I think you'll all appreciate this in this class, wanted to firmly reject relativism. In an essay that he published in 1911, he attacked what he called the flood of positivism and pragmatism, which latter exceeds the former in its relativism. And he attacked historicism, calling it, quote, romantic philosophy that rejects any belief whatever in an absolute philosophy and instead offers the relative justification of every philosophy in its own time. Where does that historicism come from? Hegel, right? Every level of consciousness, every way of looking at things is justified in its own time, but it's in the process of developing. So nobody can have any absolute philosophy. Everything must be relative. And of course, positivism is relativistic. Pragmatism is relativistic. And Husserl said this is what he was out to defeat. He wanted to reject relativism. And if I can put this in historical and cultural context, in 1935, after the Nazis had been in power, Husserl maintained that Europe was in a crisis and that what was responsible for the crisis in Europe was the gradual decay of confidence about rational certainty. Since Europe doesn't believe that rational certainty is possible, that's what accounts for the cultural crisis in which they were then enmeshed, the expression of which was the Nazi takeover. So Husserl, I mean, in this sense, well, we're with him. Go for it, Edmund. This is right. We want to get rid of the relativism of the positivist, the historicist, the pragmatist, and we realize that if we don't have rational certainty, that our culture suffers eventually because there's nothing by which we can live and be sure. And so Husserl sought out to reconstruct confidence in a universally valid truth. He believed that one of the primary reasons that Europe had lost any confidence in a universally valid truth was because of the methods of natural science. Naturalism had led people to think that the methods that are applied to, say, physics or math or chemistry could be applied to a knowledge of man's spirit as well. But according to Husserl, when you try to extend the methods of natural science to a discussion of man's psychology or his consciousness, you're engaged in an aberration that does not really pay attention to the process of experience at all. It's the furthest thing from being empirically realistic, because anybody who attends to inner experience or consciousness will realize that what he is experiencing, things like thinking, willing, imagining, and so forth, are utterly different from the material objects that the physicist studies. Now, we've talked about this in philosophy over and over again in the past, okay? When I think about myself as a free individual, I'm not anything like that analysis of the filet mignon steak out there, or analysis of chopping a tree down. What physicists and chemists are talking about isn't anything like what I experience when I look inside and say, okay, what's my consciousness like? Has anybody looked inside and found that kind of chemical analysis of himself? Of course not. And so Husserl says the naturalists are to blame for leading us to think that you can apply those methods to consciousness as well. He said that's just an aberration, totally out of place. He believed that the natural sciences were uncritical of their own assumptions. They were naive about the nature of what they were talking about. They don't analyze time, they don't analyze space, but they talk about things being in time and space. They assume a kind of naive dualism that says the physical world is dependent on the mind. The physical world comes down to how we perceive it, how we experience it. And then they turn around and they treat minds, which are experiencing the physical world, as though they were physical bodies. Natural science wants to treat the mind like a body. And so Husserl proposed a method of study that was radically different from natural science. And he maintained that this new method of study, phenomenology, would become a foundation for reconstructing all of the other sciences. All right, so what's he trying to do in his new phenomenological method? He's trying to gain clarity and certainty. If we can get clear about the objects of perception, we can get clear about the objects of experience, then we can have certainty. That is to say, there will be a self-given quality and a completeness and simplicity about the objects that we experience if we get clear about them. And once we get clear about them, there's no reason not to be certain then of what we have clearly analyzed in our own consciousness. Let me quote him. He says, "If we see an object standing out in complete clearness, if we carried out processes of discrimination and conceptual comprehension, the statement faithfully expressing this has then its justification. If we ask why the statement is justified and ascribe no value to the reply, I see that it is so, we fall into absurdity." Okay, so according to Husserl, you do an analysis of consciousness, the way in which you experience and are conscious of the world. And when you do that, you'll get to the place where you have a clear perception. Things will stand before you with a kind of self-given completeness. And he says, at that point, when somebody says, how can you be sure of that? He says, the only answer that fits is, I see that it is so. I'm just having a direct seeing, if you will, of the nature of reality, once I've done this analysis and gained complete clarity by it. Now let's compare this to some previous philosophers that we've looked at. Kierkegaard maintained that individuals cannot gain clarity and rationality by their own efforts. And that's why Kierkegaard wanted to make a leap of faith, regardless of absurdity. Husserl says, no, the individual can gain certainty by introspection and phenomenological analysis. John Dewey, whom we haven't studied yet, is going to argue that we don't have to worry about not having intellectual certainty of things. We can be quite satisfied with approximations. We go through the process of approximating the truth, and then, you know, we try things out experimentally in the world, and then we come back and improve our approximation. And that's what life is all about. Dewey would have said about Husserl's desire to gain complete clarity and certainty, the man's neurotic, maybe mildly so, but that's saying something more about him than it is about the nature of philosophy or the world. Nietzsche regarded the belief that the truth can be gradually approximated, that is Dewey's approach, as itself a symptom of neurosis. According to Nietzsche, we should enjoy the uncertainty of things, and it's a sign of our strength that we embrace the uncertainty, and what? Like the Übermensch, the Superman, we assert our own values against this. So Husserl, you see, is on the far side from subjectivism, and yet he's trying to gain his objectivity, his clarity and certainty, by an analysis of the subject of knowledge. Now, I don't really think this has been done. I, as you know already, I'm not going to go with the phenomenologist. But it's quite a program. I mean, you have to give him credit for boldness here. Well, how are we going to gain this clarity and certainty when we look inside and analyze the objects of our experience? For Husserl, it begins with radical doubt. In this sense, he's very much like Descartes. It begins with radical doubt. And it's so radical that what he tells us is that we must not just doubt this, that, and the other particular belief we may have, but we must come to doubt the world as a whole. As a whole. And this doubting of the world as a whole, that I don't know anything about the world, I have no preconceptions about the nature of reality or even of myself, the subject of experience. To completely suspend all of my preconceptions is called bracketing. We bracket our experience. Every thesis that we have, every preconception that we have, as he says, set out of action. We disconnect it or we bracket it. We set it aside. We come with no assumptions whatsoever. This doubt is so radical that according to Husserl, one must cultivate it. It's not easy to doubt absolutely everything and just look at experience at, in its raw form, if you will, as you actually have it without, if you will, prejudicing the matter with what you expect to find. So radical is this doubt that it can be likened to this. It would be one thing for me to say, I believe that Jay's car is in the parking lot right now, but of course there is some reason for doubt because I'm not looking directly at it, but it was parked there and I don't think anybody has stolen it, and I don't expect things to just go out of existence like poof. So I think that his car is in the parking lot, but I can doubt that. Now somebody might say, okay, you can suspend your belief that the car is in the parking lot because there's some reason to doubt it. But now what if I were to walk outside, walk right up to the car, be right next to it, put my hand on it? At that point, it'd be a lot harder to doubt it, right? But Husserl says, you must doubt everything. Because, after all, I might be dreaming that I'm putting my hand on the car. So I have to say, well, I'm having an experience of... All right, so to begin phenomenological analysis, you must bracket your experience, doubt everything, suspend all of your beliefs about the natural world as a whole. And when we do this, according to Husserl, we're going to be able to come into contact with the richness of reality. In this sense, he's somewhat parallel to the views of a Schopenhauer or a Bergson. Remember, I already likened Schopenhauer and Bergson one another. Both of them said we have to distrust our epistemological theories as they are modeled after physics, for instance. Physics is not the best way to understand the world. Rationality, understood as physical analysis, is not going to get us in touch with ultimate reality. There is a superior kind of knowledge available to us, however, that is a direct, immediate experience. A direct, immediate experience, not the conceptual, discursive thinking that you find in rationality or physics. So Bergson and Schopenhauer say, put physics, put reasoning aside, that you might have a direct experience of reality. Okay? Well, in a sense, that's what Husserl is saying. Husserl is saying, bracket everything. Put it all aside so that you might now come up against reality directly, rather than mediated by your preconceptions and your ways of thinking. When we suspend all of our beliefs, all of our truth claims that are part of our ordinary cognitive process, Husserl said, far from being in a state of not knowing anything, we'll then find ourselves in the presence of truths of great importance that would have escaped our attention if we had not done phenomenological analysis. And I hope that you get this in your notes, because it is really important. He said, what is needed here in the cultivating of this bracketing, this radical doubt, what is needed is, quote, a personal transformation comparable to a religious conversion. Comparable to a religious conversion. Well, now what happens when we put aside all of our beliefs, all of our preconceptions, and we've come to this religious conversion of neutrality, and we just come right up against the raw reality of our consciousness? What's left, of course, when we doubt everything, is just consciousness itself. And because a person's attitude is wholly disinterested after he's bracketed experience, what he observed is something that was never observed before. Now we can come to observe the essential nature of pure consciousness. We've gotten rid of all of our preconceptions, all of our presuppositions, all of our expectations, and we just come right up against, have a direct experience in a way that we've never had before of the essential nature of consciousness. And when I observe myself without all these presuppositions and other things in the way, what I encounter is a multitude of mental acts. I perceive, I think, I imagine, I dream, on and on. All these things are going on inside me in terms of my consciousness. And every one of these acts, imagining, dreaming, judging, thinking, all of those mental acts have their own particular kind of object. Remember, consciousness is what? Intentionality. Consciousness is directed toward an object. So when I study the acts of my consciousness, I can come to know the nature of the objects of that consciousness too, and there's a rich variety and display of them. Thus, consciousness involves both an act of intending, I intend when I think, when I imagine, when I dream, when I perceive, acts of intending, as well as intended objects of all those acts. So now that I'm looking directly at my consciousness in a way that I never could have before I bracketed, when I explore that, I come to find the essences of things. I come to find the essences of things. Husserl likened this to archaeology. He said, to study being, to find the essence of things, is not to look at some other kind of reality, the noumena of Kant, or the forms of Plato, or even the elan vital of Bergson. To know the essences of things is rather to penetrate deeper and deeper into the one and only reality we have, and that's consciousness. And so phenomenology is like the archaeologist digging deeper and deeper, getting further down into consciousness that we might find the ultimate object, the essences of all things. Set that in contrast to what I taught you about Nietzsche. What did Nietzsche say? He's using a more philological analogy. And as the philologist tries to reconstruct the original object, the text, he never can get back to the original. He can only have interpretations and interpretations of interpretations. However, archaeologists, though they have things covered with dirt, you know, and layers of other civilizations, they go deeper and deeper until they finally get down to the bottom. And so Nietzsche is the philologist philosopher, only interpretations available. Husserl is the archaeologist philosopher. If you'll look inside yourself, bracket everything out, you can get deeper and deeper and you'll finally discover the essences of things. What is an essence? It is that about an object that makes it this sort of object rather than another sort of object. The essence is what gives the discriminating character of things. And when we see the essence of things, it is completely present to us on every occasion that it is present to us. That is, we don't just get fleeting glimpses of essences. When we have that direct awareness, we see things in utter clarity for what they are, the essence is completely present to me. Well, boy, this is tough stuff, I know. It's not what you're accustomed to. What I'm going to go back and do is I'm going to try to give you 5 or 6 easy propositions to summarize the detail of what we've been looking at. So just look at this as kind of a summation along the way, and then I want to criticize it. Question?
Yeah, what's the difference between what he calls an essence and Kant's noumena? What the thing is in itself?
Well, it's the biggest difference in all the world. The noumena are not objects for consciousness. They're objects beyond consciousness. For Husserl, the essences are all in consciousness. They're objects for consciousness. So that's why they're phenomena rather than noumena. Okay, I'll try to put it to you easily. If you've been dozing off or kind of being frustrated with the details here, you can at least get this much down. Phenomenology holds that the object of knowledge is not constructed by consciousness itself. Is not constructed by consciousness itself. Against empiricism and idealism, the phenomenologist says nothing can be learned about the nature of reality merely by studying the psychological processes by which we obtain knowledge. The process of obtaining knowledge doesn't tell us about the nature of reality. We need to look at the actual phenomena, what we have, whether we've obtained it in a certain way or not. Thirdly, all of our thoughts are intentional in character. That is, they have a referring quality to them. Every idea is an idea of. Every thought is a thought of. Every will is a will of the following or toward the following. Every imagination is an imagination of. So everything that's in consciousness, all of our thoughts have this character of referring to something beyond themselves. Remember, beyond themselves. Consciousness doesn't refer to consciousness. Consciousness refers to an object of consciousness. It always has that intentionality, that referring beyond itself, or if you will, it has the character of ofness. Consciousness is never consciousness, pure and simple. It's consciousness of something beyond consciousness. Now, in order to prepare to do philosophy and science, we need to describe our experience in a way that's independent of any kind of presuppositions. We need to bracket our experience so that all presuppositions, all expectations, preconceptions are set aside. Then we can describe what's in consciousness directly. And while we're making these judgments about the objects of consciousness, we are not even concerned whether they are appearance or reality. That's not an issue. It's just what's the nature of these objects. And as we describe them, we're able to set aside those things which are peculiar to particular facts, the contingent matters of experience, so that we can now pay attention to what is essential, or if you will, the ideal features of every phenomena. Okay? So what's true of every experience that I have? What is essential to every experience? And I'll find things like intersubjectivity and other universal features when I look at the objects of my experience. Well, we've probably gone deeper into phenomenology than any of you wanted. And I have to admit that I'm doing it because I think it's only responsible to give you a well-rounded view of the 20th century. But I'm not a phenomenologist. And I don't, as you already know, spend a lot of my time studying the phenomenologists and trying to apply their insights and so forth. There are a number of problems with phenomenology. Let me begin with that one that you might think is just a prejudice of an analytical philosopher. I already told you that, in a sense, I'm kind of repulsed by all the jargon and the way of speaking and all these arcane expressions and new words. And I always wondered, do we know what we're talking about here? I mean, does all of this make sense? Is it really clear? So let's ask, why does Husserl use the language that he does? Why does he choose this kind of language? His answer would be this: I have to develop a new language because all of the language that you might use from your ordinary experience is prejudiced with preconceptions, presuppositions. And so by using that language, I'm not able to effectively bracket out everything so that I might have a direct, unmediated, sighting of the object of my consciousness. Well, now, what do you think I'm going to say back to this? I'm going to say, well, what makes you think your language doesn't have its own assumptions? Aren't there things implicit in your vocabulary, just like there are things implicit in mine?